More than 400,000 New Yorkers live in New York City's public housing. This week, WNYC's Stephen Nesson is profiling one family in the nation's largest public housing project, the Queensbridge Houses. In this second of four stories, he examines how public housing went from a replacement to substandard housing to a stigmatized problem of its own in search of a solution.
It went pretty good. It was special ed students, I-7.
58 years after she moved to Queensbridge and watched her 12 children grow up, Virgie Alston, the 83-year-old matriarch of a sprawling family, still has a full house. Grandchildren flop on the couch after school, watching TV, sending text messages, or playing cribbage. The older children still swing by to check the mail and to check on Virgie.
Mine ain't mail for me.
That box, you see that box on top?
It's too late.
You didn't have your name on, it's yours.
It's a large and tight family. Cheap and available public housing allowed the Alstons to live together and around Queensbridge for over 60 years. Walking around here, it's not hard to find an Alston. At the community center, on a walkway, on the basketball court, on the corner. Virgie and her husband Walter arrived in Queensbridge in 1954, when whites outnumbered blacks by 28%. In the early years, Virgie would hop on the nearby train into Manhattan with her children to do grocery shopping, until one day, her neighbor, an Irish woman, stopped her.
Excuse the language. She said, "Why the hell are you going to all those kids?" She said, "Bring them here." And from then on, she would buy the kids with me. Then sometimes she'd come downstairs in the evening to go take in a movie. Used to be a movie right around here on the 40th Avenue. It was amazing. This was an Irish lady. She said, "Irish don't like black." I thought, "I don't know about that." I said, "I like this Irishman." I said, "She's all right with me."
That woman would later be named godmother to one of Virgie's sons. But the number of white residents Virgie remembers in the late 50s was shifting fast. Queensbridge went from 98% white in 1946 to 46% 20 years later.
Change in the racial complexion, quite literally, of public housing residents coincided with the boom in American suburbs.
Owen Goodfriend is director of the Urban Affairs Program at Hunter College and says this change had to do with the availability of housing for whites and the limited options for blacks.
At the same time that many white Americans were able to participate in government-subsidized suburban single-family homes, lots of African Americans were moving towards public housing in cities.
From early on, Mayor LaGuardia's philosophy that public housing should be an extension of city services like public colleges, public hospitals, and public water ran afoul of vested interests. Opponents called it communism. Landlords thought the city was competing with them for middle-income paying tenants. And advocates for the poor argued that affordable housing should be dedicated to the most needy. By the 1960s, NYCHA had eased its restrictions, making it easier for the poor and the homeless to enter public housing. As working-class white residents streamed out, poverty in public housing became concentrated. The culture at NYCHA was also changing. Growing up, members of the Alston family remember fearing fines from the NYCHA police for minor infractions like playing ball on the grounds, walking on the grass, or stepping on the benches. But nothing did more to change life in New York public housing than a 1971 lawsuit brought by a couple evicted for keeping a dog illegally. The resulting consent decree, known as Escalera, tied NYCHA's hands by imposing a stringent eviction process. Fritz Umbach is a specialist in criminal history of New York at John Jay College, and said one housing official told him, with this ruling,
they couldn't even evict Jack the Ripper. And the police force and the residents who had worked so closely together begin to go their separate ways.
And in the 70s and 80s, as the drug epidemic gripped the projects, crime in NYCHA exploded.
Partly as a consequence of the crack epidemic, but also because of this changing relationship between tenants and the police force.
So much so that according to NYCHA expert Owen Goodfriend,
by the 1970s, public housing and urban both became identified in the public mind as non-white.
That was when many members of the Alston family saw the benches of their childhood overrun with junkies. Many Alstons succumbed to drug addiction too. Virgie and her husband didn't know much about drugs, but they knew when one of their children began acting strangely.
Well, that drug business, that was the worst time in my life, to tell the truth. That was the worst. I didn't know what drugs was. And I'd never seen it, never experienced it, and didn't know what to look for, to tell the truth. But you can tell them some change come in your kids. So all you do is say a prayer and keep talking to them. That's all I could do.
One by one, the Alston boys got arrested. Chick, the oldest brother, was the first. In the mid-70s, he was charged with manslaughter along with several others. Eventually, six out of the seven Alston boys served time for various crimes, many involving drugs.
This whole neighborhood just turned into hell.
That's Pat Alston, one of Chick's sisters. She's 55 years old now.
We were all playing, and all of a sudden we couldn't go to certain areas. We couldn't go to the avenue anymore. Literally, we saw people overdose on the bench outside.
She remembers around age 12 wondering, how did things get so bad?
How did it go from just how nice it was to every day was fighting in the house because my brother would be nodding on the floor. My father would be like, get out of here with that in front of these kids.
In less than three decades, public housing had gone from a solution to decaying urban housing to a growing problem. And some Alstons had gone from ideal tenants to participants in the growing social ills of the day. For WNYC, I'm Stephen Nesson.